On the program today, we are focusing on some interesting health issues that might be on your mind after a week of holiday meals and family gatherings. Later, we will tell you about some interesting new findings about depression in new mothers who are living in multi-generational households. But we're going to start by talking about obesity, which affects one in three Americans. Last year, you might remember, the American Medical Association, the nation's largest physicians group, classified obesity as a disease. AMA officials hoped the change would steer more medical attention to obesity. But now a new study says people actually make poorer diet choices when they think of obesity as a disease. The study is from the journal Psychological Science. Crystal Hoyt is the lead author, and she's with us now from member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. Crystal Hoyt, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Michelle.
And for additional perspective, we've also called Dr. Leslie Walker, chief of adolescent medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital. Among her duties is counseling her patients on nutrition and weight, and she's with us from member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Walker, welcome back to you. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Crystal, I'm going to start with you. Your team did three separate experiments with more than 700 participants, and you found that obese participants who read a news article about the AMA declaring obesity a disease were less likely to be concerned about their weight and more likely to choose high-calorie food. So, first, I'm curious about what gave you the idea to test this idea, and why do you think the findings turned out as they did?
So as a social psychologist, as soon as the AMA decided to label obesity as a disease, I was interested in the impact of this label, the psychological impact on of this label on people. Might it be the case that thinking that one has a disease makes people think that weight's unchangeable and attempts at weight management seem pointless? So my colleagues, Jenny Burnett, Lisa Oster-Gussman, and I decided to test this research.
And why do you think? And so you think that what it was kind of a disinhibitor, where people felt, well, there's nothing I can do. Is that what you think happened?
Exactly. What we think is going on here is that the disease message shifts people's beliefs regarding the controllability of body weight. Right. So psychologists call these beliefs, whether we think human attributes can be fixed or changeable, mindsets. In this case, we have weight mindsets, and a fixed mindset's a belief that regardless of effort, my weight's relatively stable. Whereas a growth mindset's the belief that, well, with hard work, I can change my weight.
Mm. And did find that the disease classification had a good impact on people's body image.
Exactly. So on the positive side, we found that the obesity as a disease message increased body satisfaction among obese individuals, and probably did so because it removed the shame of obesity as a moral failing.
So Dr. Walker, what do you make of these findings? Dr. Walker? I think, have we lost Dr. Walker? Okay. All right. Well, Crystal Hoyt, one of the things we were interested in talking about is this whole question of whether disease versus chronic medical condition. You know, is there a difference? Some people, I know some physicians prefer a chronic medical condition instead of a disease. Is there a difference in that? What does that mean?
That's a good question. What does that mean? And so as a disclaimer, we haven't conducted any research on, you know, what's the impact of labeling something a chronic medical condition. Our interest in thinking of the disease label was because people see disease as a fixed chronic state and one in which that we don't have a lot of control over.
So Dr. Walker, I take it you're back?
Yes.
Happy about that?
Yes, okay.
Well, you know what we're talking about here. And the question is, you know, I understand that you prefer not to use the word disease and you prefer a chronic medical condition. What difference does that make?
Well, I mean, it's what it is. It's a chronic medical condition. It's not something that, you know, a person could do a diet and they're better. You know, it's a lifelong work and lifestyle change. Most adults that are obese were obese as kids. And you know, there's a lot of reasons beyond just diet and exercise that people become obese, and it's not something that's easily fixed. And people need to understand that and understand that it's not just about their self-control or losing control with food. There's a lot that goes into somebody becoming obese, and there's a lot that goes into trying to manage that and be healthy.
Have you, when the AMA made this announcement that they were going to start using this terminology obesity as a disease, is that something that you incorporated in your discussions with patients right away?
That's something, talking about it being a chronic medical condition, an actual condition, and not just something that has to do with people's self-control, I've always talked about. And, you know, in some ways we were very happy that it is categorized that way, because right now insurance doesn't cover all the, you know, nutritionists or the, you know, the team. Like we have a team of people that works on our obesity program for adolescents and young adults, and it's not covered by insurance. And so it would be nice to have the things that we know that have evidence base that work for people to help them be covered, and having it actually categorized is one step toward having that happen.
Have you observed, though, what the researchers led by Crystal Hoyt have observed, too, which is this, that in some patients and some of the people you work with, it kind of removes some of the incentive to take these positive steps. Have you seen that?
Well, I think what I would see that as is it's removing some of the pain that people have. And, you know, to be obese, you deal with daily discrimination, bullying, feeling guilty, shame, you know, that it's your fault that you can't just manage this. And to hear that maybe it's not completely your fault, that maybe there's something else going on beyond your self-control, might give people a little more release to say, man, maybe I don't have to try to drink this Diet Coke all the time. Maybe I don't have to eat just one pea and, you know, and really feel hungry. Maybe I can eat something I want once in a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're really working with people to help them manage this, it's about having a different relationship with food and not feeling so guilty. That's one of the things that helps. And it could be that they're beginning to see that and feel less guilty.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about classifying obesity as a disease. We're talking about new research that says that classifying the obesity as a disease may affect people's diet and health choices. Our guests are physician Dr. Leslie Walker, that's who was speaking just now. Also, psychology professor Crystal Hoyt, whose research found that people are actually making poorer diet choices when they are exposed to this information that obesity is a disease. So, Crystal Hoyt, what about that? I mean, I understand that you can see where, I'm sure you can understand Dr. Walker's point of view from kind of a clinical perspective, trying to give people, remove some of the stigma, which might open up the opportunity for people to address this issue. But your findings suggest that really, at least in the short run, having been confronted with this, that people were actually kind of working less hard to address this. How do you want people to address these findings, Crystal Hoyt?
Yes. So while our findings do show psychological costs in terms of self-regulation and deciding where obese individuals place less focus on health-focused dieting, less concern for weight, ultimately predicting higher calorie food choices, that's one psychological outcome. And what Dr. Walker's pointing to is another very important potential psychological outcome of labeling obesity as a disease, in that it might usher in a greater tolerance and serve to decrease discrimination against obese individuals. And that's actually the current line of research that we are exploring in our lab.
Tell me more about that, Crystal Hoyt, if you would. That was going to be my next question, which is, what are some of the other things you're interested in learning about and researching?
So right now we are looking at this idea of, is it the case, and how is it the case, that perhaps labeling obesity a disease decreases this stigma, a self-stigma, and we kind of found that in our research, where obese individuals felt less body dissatisfaction, were more satisfied with their body, but might it also decrease the stigma that others have against them? And we know, I'm a social psychologist, and in my field and in other related fields, we know that reducing stigma against individuals, such as the overweight, can be useful in enabling them to attain their goals, such as weight loss.
Dr. Walker, what about the, is there an analogy here with substance addiction, with drug addiction? You know, for decades now, people have referred to substance addiction as a disease. And I wonder if that has had the same kind of effect. I mean, on the one hand, food is different in that it might be hard to avoid those substances that you're addicted to, like alcohol or you know, drugs, but you don't need them to live, whereas food you do need to live. So that's kind of a different scenario. But have you seen with patients that have drug addictions or substance addictions that the idea of categorizing it as a disease, have you found that to be helpful or disinhibiting in the same way that you see with food?
Yeah, I think it is. It is helpful because people realize that there's something more going on here. You know, when you have something, and you know, addiction is a disease. We can see it now. We have the evidence looking at the brain that, you know, your brain changes when addiction occurs, and it you know, the drive is enormous to use. And so people understanding that, and us and as researchers understanding how to address it in that way, makes us get a little bit closer to really being able to deal with it. And it is hard because, you know, when you're having obesity, you you still have to eat, and that's your trigger. And, you know, it's right there in front of you every day. You need it, and it's very difficult. And I think moving forward, we can find ways to help manage that a little better if we see it differently.
Crystal Hoyt, can I give you the final word here? What would you like people to draw from this study?
I guess my final word or advice would be the importance of mindsets and how crucial they are for individuals beginning to diet and continue to try and reach their dieting goals. Research by my colleague Jenny Burnett and others shows very clearly that believing that weight is changeable, that is, having a growth mindset, sustains motivation and predicts greater weight loss than having a fixed mindset.
Crystal Hoyt is a psychology professor at the University of Richmond. She's author of the study Obesity as a Disease in the journal Psychological Science. Dr. Leslie Walker is chief of adolescent medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital. I thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Now we'd like to turn to a story about how views of crime and justice are changing when it comes to the nation's drug laws. In the 1980s and 90s, during the crack epidemic, many low-level offenders received harsh sentences that kept thousands of people incarcerated, sometimes for decades. But the Obama administration has been re-examining the wisdom of those sentences and is pushing to open up the clemency process for nonviolent drug offenders. This week, the Justice Department will announce new criteria for pardons and commutations, a move that's intended to encourage thousands of people now incarcerated for drug crimes to apply for early release. We wanted to hear more about this, so we've called NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Welcome. Thanks, Carrie, for joining us.
Great to be here.
So do we know who or what is motivating this effort? I mean, activists have been complaining for years that too many people are locked up for just too long, especially people who are nonviolent offenders. But this has been kind of one of those slow boil arguments that nobody seems to be paying attention to. Now somebody is. Do we know why?
I think the message from those activists reached the ears of Barack Obama at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Michelle. From all I've been able to glean from sources, this issue is personal to him, in part because the drug laws are enforced in ways that disproportionately hurt minority defendants. And the notion that nonviolent offenders could be locked up for decades, he thinks is a civil rights issue and a public safety issue. He thinks there are too many people in prison that don't pose a threat to public safety. And Attorney General Eric Holder agrees with him.
So what's going to be different now? What exactly is going to change?
What's going to happen is that there's going to be a process opened up to thousands of people currently behind bars who are behind bars without ties to gangs, without violent offenses in their backgrounds, and for people with clean records in prison. And those people will be invited or encouraged to apply for commutations or pardons, in essence, to get out of prison early. The Justice Department says that it expects many thousands of offenders will be eligible, but it may take a little while to figure out who makes the cut.
Does this solely affect people who are serving time on federal charges, or does this also affect people in state prisons or serving time on state charges?
Michelle, this only affects the population of about 219,000 inmates in federal custody now. But it's important to note that many states have already pursued these kinds of reforms at the state level, including, Michelle, states that we consider to be red, Republican governors, Republican legislators. And that has, in fact, given this administration some political cover for making these reforms, because in the past, many Democrats have been wary of being perceived as weak on crime.
How is the Justice Department getting out the word to about this? I mean, I understand this is relatively new information, but how is this information being distributed?
So the Deputy Attorney General, Jim Cole, the number two at the Justice Department, had a private meeting in February with advocates for prisoners and people who want to see sentencing reform. That includes groups that are very familiar to you and your audience, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, the ACLU, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the Deputy Attorney General later this week is expected to announce some new guidelines for the Bureau of Prisons to let inmates know they may be eligible for these kinds of reforms. So they're slowly getting the word out, but it's going to take a little while to filter to those U.S. prisons all over the country.
You know, this may be a silly question, but you know, you can have a policy change, but is there the administrative infrastructure to actually implement the change. I mean, there have been stories for years, including stories from the investigative group ProPublica, about how an inspector general's reports saying that the pardon attorney's office is simply overwhelmed and isn't doing a very good job at processing the applications that are already before it. So what about that?
That's a real fear of some of these advocates that, you know, there are not very many attorneys in the pardon office now who review these petitions. They get lots of petitions, and they're about to get thousands more. So what Eric Holder, the attorney general, has said is that he's going to create a special team of lawyers and move more lawyers into that office. And those lawyers are going to have backgrounds, not just Michelle as prosecutors, but people who have defended clients as well, which is important because it's a little odd to begin with to think about the people passing judgment on whether criminals can get out of prison early are those same people who prosecuted them in the first place. There's a bit of a mindset issue there.
You know, one other point, though, Carrie, is that President Obama, historically speaking, has actually been pretty stingy with pardons and commutations. He did 8 of them last December. He did another one earlier this month for a man who was actually serving more time as a result of a typo. So can we expect that he will move on these? I mean, this is a policy change of his administration, but his own sort of when he's exercised his own discretion very sparingly here.
I looked up the statistics before coming in, Michelle. President Obama has granted 1 out of every 175 petitions for pardons and commutations. That is fewer than Presidents Nixon, Ford, Carter, Clinton, and both Presidents Bush. Remarkable. So the tone at the top may be coming from the president. He wants to see these things. It remains to be seen whether his underlings are going to act.
I was going to ask you that. We only have about a minute left. Why do we think he's been so stingy with commutations and pardons? Do we have a theory about that? Is that what you said cited at the beginning, Democrats, particularly liberals, being fearful of appearing soft on crime and alienating their middle-class voters? Do we know? Do we have a theory?
I think that's part of the issue. Remember that President Clinton, in his waning days in office, issued pardon for Mark Rich, and that became a political scandal and a federal investigation that ensnared, among other people, our current Attorney General, Eric Holder. So they're a little bit wary of the politics of these issues.
Carrie Johnson is NPR's justice correspondent. She was kind enough to join us here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Carrie Johnson, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And now it's time for Muses and Metaphor. That's our ode to National Poetry Month. All through April, we are featuring original tweet-length poems, 140 characters or less, delivered by Twitter and written by NPR listeners. And new this year, some of our regular contributors. Today, we are hearing from 2 of our regular Beauty Shop contributors. Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor of PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian news and commentary site. Mickey Kendall is a writer and pop culture critic with HoodFeminism.com. Welcome, ladies. Thank you for joining us on this little different assignment for you.
Awesome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Bridget Johnson, are you normally a poet? And you're a private poet, secret poet?
And I don't know it. Well, you know, I kind of think of poetry as kind of Joe and Little Women, where it's like if you do what you know, then it sounds okay. But if you try and, you know, go off and become some sort of, you know, great romantic poet and that's not really in you, then it looks kind of weird. So,
well, but you were up to the challenge and we appreciate that. And you've actually been going strong tweeting on TMM poetry. Did you enjoy it? Did you rose to the challenge, but was it fun for you?
I did enjoy it. Yes. Yes.
Was it hard? Did you find the 140 character limit difficult?
Not too much because, you try to not be too wordy anyways as a journalist. So, you know, you kind of keep it compact and keep it to one thought. And
okay. Okay. So you're a natural. Mickey, what about you? Are you a secret poet, too?
I am the kind of poet who writes things and then puts them away.
Oh, the most part. So you're gonna take a risk here and expose your private poetry process. So what was your process, Mickey? How did you decide what to write about? How do you normally decide?
So I actually tend to sort of stumble on things that sound good. I write longer form fiction, and I'm used to searching for a good turn of phrase, a way to say something that sounds new and interesting, which ties in well with poetry. It's just that 140 characters was perfect for me because I can come up with a good sentence or two. I just can't come up with 5 stanzas.
Okay. Well, so you liked the format. That worked. It worked
yes.
for you.
Yes.
All right. So now is the moment that we have been waiting for. Drum roll, please. Bridget, do you want to start?
Right, okay.
Read one of yours. Just one, because we know you've been going strong. So just pick one.
Recess, oh sweet recess, House and Senate gone. Time to play, so much to do, ghost riding the whip down Constitution Avenue.
Okay. So that was very much on your mind, referring to the congressional recess. Very nice.
Yes.
Okay, Mickey, what about you?
West African soil, Delta roots, Midwest branches, and leaves that shade the world. Blood journeys through the ages.
Wow, what was the inspiration for that?
Actually, I've been doing a family genealogy project.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, very vivid. Okay, so you've also been following the submissions on Twitter. And Mickey, do you want to share a poem that caught your attention?
Sure. I was trying to find someone who hadn't been called out before. And I really liked Dr. Mania, Pretty Little Lion is the Twitter handle. Hot coals burning, no flames, no showmanship. When it rains, we still are smoking, smoldering, sparking Jane with kin.
Oh, nice. I like it. What struck you about it?
It's one of those poems where you have to pause and really think about the imagery. That's what I generally like if I'm reading a poem. I want something that really makes me imagine what they're talking about, and so I can see a vivid picture in my mind.
I agree. I think it is. It sticks with you. It sticks to your ribs. Bridget, what about you?
So I kind of latched on to what appeared to me to be the youngest person who was tweeting, and she only had one tweet on her account, too. So it looks like she started it to do TMM poetry. And her name was Jasmine Palacios, Twitter handle Rad Jazz. And she did, fireflies twinkle like Christmas lights, glowing among the darkness, alone forever, but let there be light.
Very nice. Very nice.
And that kind of made me think this was the first time I ever saw a firefly was when I moved out here from the West Coast.
How about that?
Really? Like, what is that?
Yeah, very nice. Well, thank you both for doing this. Can you each give some advice for people who still aren't ready to, you know, take that plunge? Mickey, do you have some advice for people who might want to get started?
Start with writing. Just write a sentence. Don't worry about it rhyming. Don't worry about meter or any of the things that they're going to teach you in school. Just start with being able to describe something.
Okay. Bridget, what about you? Thoughts?
Start writing without worrying if people are going to see it on the Twitterverse. and just let it flow. And then once you start to feel what is appropriate or, you know, what you are proud to show the rest of the world, then that'll come naturally.
I can put you on the spot because you've both been so good about keeping to Twitter length that we actually have time for one or two more poems. Is there another poem, either of yours or someone else's, that you would like to share? Bridget, do you have one?
Well, you know, like I said, I was kind of sticking to what I know. So, you know, one Saturday night when I was up very, very late, I was inspired to write, with 60% voter turnout, 65% male, 35% female, brave Afghans turned Taliban plans into a great colossal fail.
Okay. Well, here's another of yours that I like. It's dear to my heart. And this was one of Bridget Johnson's. Legs ache after day of running around the hill. Gotta give credit where credit is due. Nancy Pelosi does this in Jimmy Choo's. I thought that was right on time. Mickey, what about you? Do you have one more that you'd like to share? Either
yes.
Yours or someone else's.
This one is someone else's. Hawana Sullivan Jansen. If there is something out there that gives me light, please do not find it. For the darkness fills me up and makes me whole.
Wow. Like that. What struck you about it?
I'm so about the imagery, but it was a warm. It's not a darkness to be afraid of. It's a darkness to welcome and be comforted by.
There have been so many great. There's wonderful kind of just images that you can kind of toss around. You know, it's almost like a mint that you can kind of carry around with you, kind of dissolving slowly and enjoying throughout the day. It's just
kind of a word snack.
Yeah. I love it. Well, thank you both so much. Mickey Kendall is a writer and pop culture critic for hoodfeminism.com. She joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. She joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. They are two of our Beauty Shop regulars, and they are joining us for our Twitter poetry series. Thank you, ladies. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we still would like to hear from you. Tweet us your poems. They have to be 140 characters or less using the hashtag TMM Poetry. And now the regular feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we invite some of our guests to tell us about the songs on their playlists. We caught up with entertainer Margaret Cho during her latest comedy tour, and she gave us a few of her favorite tunes.
My name is Margaret Cho. I am a comedian, an actor, an author, and I do lots of other things like music. And part of my obsession with music is that my love of songs, and I have a lot of favorite songs. The one that I'm listening to nonstop right now is Cuddly Toy by Harry Nielsen. This is one of the greatest songs ever written and recorded, and it's really something that's more familiar to people from the Monkees television show. It's something that Davy Jones sang, but actually, in truth, it's a Harry Nielsen song, and it is really, really fantastic. It's got a little bit of Beatles influence there. It's from the golden age of music.
I never told you that I love no other. You must have dreamed it in your sleep. You're not the only cuddly toy that was ever enjoyed by any boy. You're not the only choo-choo train that was left out in the rain the day of the Santa came. La-la-la-la-la-la-la.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you.
Another song that really just gets to me is God Only Knows by the Beach Boys, which is another great, great, great song of the 60s. And Brian Wilson's melodies and his harmonies are just unbeatable and really incredible. I'm just, a huge music fan, and those are the songs I'm listening to right now in my ear.
Believe me, the world could show nothing to me.
That was comedian Margaret Cho telling us what's playing in her ear. To hear our previous conversation with her, head over to NPR.org, click on the Programs tab, and go to Tell Me More. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms or dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, we want to talk about one of the most wonderful and stressful times in a parent's life, and that is when that baby actually comes home. Exhausting, overwhelming, and for many families, it is just understood that parents or in-laws will move in for a while to change diapers, warm bottles, and in general pitch in. But according to new research, when for a while becomes forever, it can be a problem. A new study found that some new mothers who live in multi-generational households actually show higher rates of depression compared to those who don't. And this is a pattern that held true with both married and single mothers, and mothers who were rich, poor, and middle class. And it found that Latina single mothers were especially likely to experience depression if they lived in multi-generational households than if they did not. We wanted to hear more about this, so we've called on the author of the study, Joy Piontek. She's a research analyst at Duke University Center for Child and Family Policy and a mom of one. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Also joining us for additional perspective are Eliana Tardillo. She's a mom of two and a blogger for the parenting site Babbel.com. Eliana, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me today.
And Aisha Callahan is a staff writer for The Root, TheRoot.com, and a single mom of one. Aisha, welcome to you. Thank you for coming as
thank
well.
Thank you for having me.
Joy, let me start with you. This study fascinated all of us because it contradicts, you know, the lore that many people have about this. I mean, your research, as I mentioned, found that married and single moms in multi-generational households actually show higher rates of depression, but that moms who live with their partners but are not married and had one or more grandparents in the house had lower rates of depression. Why do you think that is?
Yes, so that was kind of a surprising finding. We have a couple ideas about why that might be the case. In the United States, we have really strong cultural expectations about what married couples should do and the households they should form. And one of those is being economically independent. And so it could be that these strong cultural expectations cause there to be extra pressure on these mothers. Another thing that's important to note about the study is that we just looked at one point in time, their first year. Mm-hmm. So it could be that, so we can't really discern the causal relationship. Mm-hmm. So it could be that mothers who are more likely to experience depression in that first year are less likely to move out of the household. Or it could be that living in these multi-generational households contributes to depression.
Aisha, why don't you tell us your experience? Because you lived with your mom when your son was first born,
yes.
correct? And then
yes.
she lived with you when you moved into your own place. She then lived with you. So
yes.
you kind of had both. Does this ring true to you? What is?
I think it was stressful when I lived with her when my son was first born, because we were kind of butting heads when it came to different parenting styles. You know, she's older. She knew, you know, she raised four kids. So she knew what was best. And so when you're trying to learn things on your own and you have someone basically undermining you at times, then I can see where the stress would come in, and that also probably aspects of depression. But then, like she said, it was the first year of the study. I would be interested in seeing if those women in that study, were they already suffering from postpartum or things like that?
Because, what about you though? What was your experience? And did you find it different when your mom was living in your house?
It really wasn't that different, because she still took over. You know, she's very, you know, very demanding, very, you know, overbearing at times. And when my son was older, we both had different styles of parenting. So our styles clashed. And that, you know, not only was I stressed a bit, but it kind of stressed my son out, because he didn't know, you know, who to listen to. It was like having, like, you know,
two different bosses.
Yeah, two different bosses. So he was confused. He was stressed.
Did you find that your friends didn't get it? Did they think that you were just living the life of Riley, having your mom there, built-in babysitter, and that you had to explain to them
exactly.
why it wasn't Nirvana?
Exactly. I still had to beg her to babysit. You know, I was like, I would beg for a break here and there. And she's like, you know, I'm not your built-in babysitter. She would use those terms exactly. And then, you know, when I did want her to babysit, I had to, you know, pay her. So
okay.
It wasn't something that... It was, her services were not like, you know, a nanny, you know, but she still took on that role as another head of the household, making rules and things like that.
Eliana, what about you? Your in-laws lived with you when your kids were born. Tell us about that experience. How did that go?
Right. Well, in my case, my mom passed away when I was 15.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I grew up by myself. So for me, it was, you know, I have been always grateful for their support, but at the same time, it was stressful, because when you grow up by yourself, you have your own rules, you know, and you want to learn things by yourself. So it was kind of stressful. You have all that support in there. My child was born with Down syndrome, so it was something different too. And I wasn't used to someone telling you what to do or what is going to be best for your child. So I think everything comes from that side in my case.
Did you find it stressful? It sounds like it.
It was. It was stressful because, at the other hand, I was new to the United States. And I was trying to learn how to raise a child in a different culture. So for them, it was like I was kind of crazy, because I was changing all the beliefs of being Latina, and I was following all the instructions from the pediatrician, you know. And for someone who is experiencing having a child, of course, they have their own ideas, their own rules. And I was starting again, and I really needed that privacy and that peace, you know, to get used to the idea that I have a newborn, and I also have a child with special needs, so it was kind of stressful.
So I want to go back to this, because Joy, in the study, as I mentioned earlier, the pattern held true for both wealthy, low-income, and middle-class women. But the findings really varied by race, with Latina single mothers faring particularly poorly in multi-generational households, that Latina single moms were six times more likely to experience depression if they lived in multi-generational households in the child's first year of life than if they did not. So, Joy, can I ask you first about this? And then, Eliana, of course, I want to hear your perspective. So, Joy, what do you think?
Yeah, so we don't really know why Latina mothers fared particularly poorly in the study in terms of depression. But we expect that it has something to do with cultural expectations varying between groups. But there simply isn't a lot known about multi-generational households in general. And so So we can't speak to exactly why that might be.
So, Eliana, I'm going to ask you to speculate, not ask you to speak on behalf of all, but asking you to speculate from your own experience, because I think that people have this stereotype that, you know, this is one of the strengths of the Latino community, is that people are willing to live in multi-generational households, that they kind of pool their resources, and this is actually kind of a strength. And this study finds that there's a cost. And I just wonder if you have a theory about why that might be. I mean, do you think maybe the expectations on you are really high?
Yeah. What happens is that sometimes it is not your choice, right? So when something is not your choice, of course you are going to struggle and you may be frustrated because you are not making that choice. And in my case, it was not my choice, obviously, because I was new to the United States. I was starting a family, a life. So you get depressed and you feel that I'm here, I'm stuck in here, and this is all that I have right now. So you have to do your best. And I guess that's the same with the study, right? That probably these moms, they are living with their parents or with their in-laws because they have that need. So it's not that they choose to go there and live with them and have, you know, like a big family around. So I guess that's all about.
Aisha, what do you think? I mean, one of the hypotheses here is that there is this, in this country, there's this really strong kind of expectation that you're going to make it on your own, you know, you're going to have your own place, that you are going to kind of be your own nuclear unit, with, you know, parent and child. And that even though, you know, culturally, there's a lot of, you know, history behind people kind of living in multi-generational households, somehow that it still feels a little bit like you're failing. Do you feel like that is part of the stress?
At first, I understand. I felt that, you know, because I was finished with school, but I was still at home. So, you know, I was wondering, what did I do wrong? Where did I go wrong? You know, as far as, you know, not being prepared enough to live on my own and having to live with my mother. But then after I realized that it was beneficial to me in the long run, because even though she did stress me out, I was able to, you know, save money to eventually move out on my own. But then, of course, she did move in a couple of years later.
Well, she didn't just sneak in, did she? I mean, did she? Presumably, she discussed this with you. Did she just show up one day? How did that happen?
She moved in because she relocated to Maryland for a job transfer. So, you know, no one else wanted her.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, we're going to have to get her perspective on this. If you're just joining us, we're talking about new research on multi-generational households and depression in new moms. The results might surprise you. My guests are Joy Piontek. She's a research analyst at Duke University who conducted this study. And our other guests are Aisha Callahan of TheRoot.com and Eliana Tardillo of Babbel.com. And they're talking about their personal experiences with this, both having lived with parents or in-laws when they had new babies. Joy, talk a little bit more, if you would, about, you know, you said that it was surprising. I think it is. I think the findings are surprising to many people because on the one hand, we do have this kind of cultural expectation of independence, setting up that nuclear household. On the other hand, we have a lot of romanticism, I think, about having grandma, grandpa living with us. I mean, there are a lot of TV shows where grandma, grandpa, they're, you know, kind of generally kind of reading the newspaper and imparting wisdom from time to time. But I think we have a lot of warm feelings about the idea. And what you're saying is the reality is actually quite different. Any thoughts about why that is?
Right. Yeah. No. And I feel similarly. When I first became interested in this project, it was through interviewing single moms. And really what stood out to me in doing so was that there's such a diversity in their living situation. So we don't really capture that diversity when we study families usually. And so, but I did expect that, you know, these extra hands would sort of be helpful in terms of how well mothers were doing, but they're actually a lot more complicated than that.
And I wonder, is that something to do with the fact that our lives actually do change quite a lot? I mean, one of the things that I think, you know, I've noted, and we do this parenting segment every week, is that many of us do not like the way we were raised. I mean, we can respect our parents, we can love our parents, but there are lots of things we would like to do differently, including, you know, corporal punishment, including yelling, including, you know, the way we expect our boys and girls to behave. I mean, and could you think, Joy, do you think that could be part of it, that in fact our understanding of what it is to be a parent is changing, so that it's kind of, you're inevitably butting heads with seniors?
Definitely. I mean, the way that we think about parenting has changed a lot, and so that could definitely impact those relationships.
Aisha, what do you think?
As far as, like you said, the whole disciplining and, you know, things change with time. You know, my mother was a hardcore disciplinarian and I wasn't. So she was also a yeller, a screamer. And, you know, I always spoke to my son, and she didn't realize, well, why are you talking to him? You know, you're supposed to demand attention and things like that. So it's when people have different forms of disciplining in the household, then, you know, it can be a mess. And so it's not always like, you know, a walk in a field of roses when you're living with other people.
Do you have any advice for somebody who, I mean, is there something you wish you would have told yourself then when you were just starting out as a parent? Don't do it. I kind of feel like it's don't do it.
You know, I guess I would have told myself to wait, you know, a couple of years later. So, but, you know, I'm almost 40 and my son is almost out of the house. I'm still young. Mm-hmm. Now, in hindsight now, I'm like, you know,
net
I still
plus,
have...
net minus. When you think about it, when you're really honest with yourself, yeah. Net plus, net minus.
I think it's net plus right now. Hmm. Net plus.
Eliana, so. What about you? When you're really honest with yourself, net plus, net minus, having had your in-laws living with you or living with your in-laws when you came?
Net plus, because I can tell also that they have been very supportive. I have to be grateful. But at the same time, you know, it is a reality that you want to set your own rules. You want to raise your child with your beliefs, and you want to be the best mother that you can be or the best father. And it's really hard to achieve that when you have other people around.
Is there any advice that you would have liked to have heard when you were just starting out as a parent living with your in-laws? Is there something that you think would have made a difference that perhaps you could impart?
I think it is really hard, you know. It's not that anyone made a mistake. It's just the reality that is hard to handle. It doesn't end well all the time because people is just different. And I will tell people, you know, that always getting prepared for having a child, for starting a family is important, because then you are going to have that ability to have your own place, set your own rules, raise your child, and don't have to go through all that.
Mm. Joy, is there any group that fared particularly well in your research when they lived with a parent? And we mentioned that women, people who were unmarried but living with a romantic partner and a grandparent, seemed to do better. Any other thoughts?
Yes. So, right. So cohabitating couples who lived with grandparents had lower rates of depression. The other group that had lower rates of depression was married moms who lived with a grandparent or grandparents for part of the year, but not the entire year. So married mothers who maybe were living with grandparents at the birth of their child, but were living independently by the time their child was a year old, had lower rates of depression than even women who had lived independently that whole time.
This seems to cry out for beach house. I feel beach house seems to be
yes.
Kind of the operating theme here. Joy, do you have any advice based on this research, which, as I said, surprised, I think, a lot of us when we encountered it? Do you? I don't know if you feel comfortable
yeah.
offering advice based on these findings about people who are contemplating this arrangement.
Right. And I think what's important to remember is just that the American family is so much more diverse than it was 50 years ago. And so, you know, a lot more needs to be looked at in order to fully understand these relationships and how they can be beneficial to women and how we can help strengthen multi-generational households so that they are more beneficial to mothers and to children and to all the members, really.
Yeah, one of the things you were pointing out, that there really isn't that much research on multi-generational
right.
households. That's that there's a lot of interest in families, but not a lot in these family styles. Kind of interesting about why that. What else would you like to research?
Right. So I think it would be interesting to look at these families over time. I think it's interesting that you asked the mothers whether it was a net gain or a net plus, because this was just 1 year in time. And to look at how these mothers fare over the life of their child, being able to rely on these multi-generational households at certain times, these are fluid relationships. So they generally don't last for the entire child's life at home. And so to really understand how it affects them in the long term.
Joy Piontek is a research analyst at Duke University. She joined us from there. Aisha Callahan is a staff writer for The Root and a single mom of one. She joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Eliana Tardillo is a mom of two and a blogger for the parenting site Babbel.com. She was with us from Fort Myers, Florida. Ladies, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.